I have spent my whole life watching people leave. Those words were written by David Giffels of Akron, Ohio, his hometown. Akron was once a hub for tire manufacturing giants. It was proudly known as the rubber capital of the world. Goodyear, Firestone, and Goodrich provided thousands of high-paying jobs, until those jobs migrated to places with cheaper labor. That began in the late 1970s when David Giffels was a teenager. In the years since then, he's been thinking and writing about the effects of that loss, first as a columnist at the Akron Beacon Journal, now in The Hard Way on Purpose, Essays and Dispatches from the Rust Belt. David Giffels begins his book with the story of an exhibit in 1982 at the Akron Art Museum. It showed images taken by a renowned photographer.
He spent a year or so shooting photos across the region of industry, and really what he was photographing was the end of industry, this beginning of architectural decay and of people starting to be sort of beaten down by the decline. And really what he was probably doing was kind of holding up a mirror to something that we hadn't really seen about ourselves. And to me, that at least in some ways represents the beginning of what's been, I think, a regional identity crisis for my entire adult life.
When you talk about the tire factories closing down, I mean, such an important part of Akron's identity. And in one of your essays, you're describing the dismantling of the giant smokestack at the Firestone mm-hmm. tire factory. And, I wonder, could you read a bit about this story of the smokestack coming down?
Sure. The men had erected a platform that surrounded the spire so they could take it down methodically, course by course. Handwork. They were removing the intricate puzzle of blocks a piece at a time and loading them into a bucket, which was lowered to the ground, emptied, then hauled back up for another round. I don't know why they didn't just whack the thing with a wrecking ball. Plenty of other stuff around here has been erased that way, including Firestone's main factory many years before, which the guy from the wrecking company told me once was the toughest building he had ever encountered. It took 2 years to demolish. Someone had apparently predicted permanence.
So was part of doing this book and part of your sort of curiosity about these things just sending a message that there's something to see here, there's a culture that's going away, but it's a culture, you know, worth reflecting on?
Yeah, definitely. And I wouldn't say that it was so much an overt message with a purpose as it was just kind of like organically, this is what I've come to understand having spent my whole life here. And one of the things I've come to understand is that the rest of the country doesn't pay that much attention to the post-industrial Midwest. And when it does, you know, we sort of bristle because when you have, you know, sort of been trying to redefine your identity and then, you know, in Ohio every 4 years, here come the parachutes with everybody kind of, you know, Ohio's going to pick the next president. And so
mm-hmm. it's the swing state.
Yeah. So a big instinct of this book is that sort of that bristling of pride and of wanting to tell our own story.
Very funny revelation in this book. You have a lot in common with the NBA basketball star LeBron James.
Oh, LeBron James and I are the only two people in the entire world who went straight from St. Vincent St. Mary High School in Akron, Ohio to the Cleveland Cavaliers.
We should say you were not a star basketball player, but
no,
you were
he was
with
the
team.
First pick in the draft lottery, and I was an entry-level ball boy. So,
and he becomes sort of the face and the hope of Ohio to try and get a championship. And then, as many sports fans know, he left and went to the Miami Heat. And you spoke about his decision as something that everyone should have known was coming.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of understanding nationally about how he left in that really sort of devastating and disappointing kind of way. But I think only here can we really understand what he represented, which was, you know, first of all, he was born in 1984. The term Rust Belt was invented in 1982. So he almost like completely parallels this difficult journey. He really self-identifies with being from Akron, and he's got the local area code tattooed down his forearm, and he still makes his home here. So he likes being one of us. And so to know that he left when he had the choice to stay is, man, how many people did I grow up with, professional people who left when they had the choice to stay? And do I resent them or do I understand what they did and just decide I tried to do it a different way?
I wonder if there were moments when you, you know, thought about leaving and why you decided to stay in Akron.
Yeah, actually, there was a specific moment. I had a job offer in New York that I gave a lot of thought to and talked to my wife a lot about it. And it was, you know, do we leave and go where it's going to be a more obvious sense of opportunity, or do we stay and commit to a place that kind of needs us more? And it kind of came down to, we belong here, and we belong here in a way that we're starting to kind of be proud of, that would have been different if we'd left and gone and, you know, made our way in some other place.
We began talking about sort of you and people in Akron and that part of the country trying to find the new identity, the next identity. Have you done it?
I think we have, and I think we've been doing it all along. And that identity is reinvention. You know, the University of Akron recently launched the first baccalaureate degree basically in the engineering of rust. And instead of calling it something scientific and modern sounding, it's taken on this colloquial name, the Rust Institute. And it's drawn millions of dollars in grant money, and it's drawing students who are coming to Akron to study this, you know, rust prevention technology. But to call it the Rust Institute is to not say we're ashamed of this past that was, you know, partly defined by decay, but we embrace it. It's something that's integrated with our future.
David Giffels, thank you so much for spending time with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
That's David Giffels. His book of essays about life in the Rust Belt is called The Hard Way on Purpose. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. President Jimmy Carter has written more than 24 books over the course of his career about everything from the art of aging to how to achieve peace in the Middle East. His writings are anchored by a deep-seated belief that all people should be granted the same set of rights and freedoms. In his new book, President Carter tackles one of the biggest human rights challenges head-on, the subjugation of women in cultures the world over. The book is called A Call to Action: Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And in it, President Carter argues that religious texts are often used to justify the oppression of women.
I teach Bible lessons in my church every Sunday, about 35 or 40 times a year, and I've been teaching Bible lessons since I was a midshipman at Annapolis when I was just 18 years old, so I'm fairly familiar with the entire Bible, since half of my lessons come from the Old Testament and half from the New Testament. So you can pick out individual verses throughout the Bible that shows that the verse favors your particular preference.
So does that mean that there are in some way limits to how definitive religious texts, and in particular the Bible, can be when trying to sort right from wrong?
Well, in the book throughout it, I quote verses from the Quran and quote verses from the Holy Bible as interpreted by the Catholic Church, and to show that you can interpret the Bible either way. And I think that the fact is that in modern society, we need to look on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was written right after the Second World War, as you know, as a basis for how to treat women and girls. And when this was issued, the church leaders didn't speak out at that time, although throughout the Declaration of Human Rights, it prescribes absolute equality between men and women.
You say in the opening to your book that the violence against women that happens in the world is perpetuated in large part by the United States. How so?
Well, I don't blame the United States uniquely, but the fact is that the United States has the most influence of any country on earth. There's no doubt about that. And we have a terrible affliction here of slavery. There's a greater number of slaves sold now across international borders, according to annual reports by the U.S. State Department, than there was in the 18th and 19th centuries. And the total slavery income in these days, we call it human trafficking, is more than $32 billion.
You have been working with leaders from many different countries throughout Africa and Asia on women's issues. And I wonder how you think about culturally complicated issues like female circumcision, which is a practice that has been categorically dismissed as wrong by the West. But in many cultures, it is accepted as a rite of passage.
Well, you know, Egypt is a country in which I've been deeply involved. And UNICEF reports that more than 95% of all the women and girls in Egypt have been sexually mutilated. Well, this is a horrible affliction that is in more than 90% of Djibouti and all the women in Sudan, all the women in Somalia, all the women in Egypt, and more than 50% in more than a dozen other countries.
That is also a practice that is perpetrated by women. It is mothers who are doing this to daughters.
That's exactly right. Mothers impose it on their daughters just because they had to suffer the same consequence when they were children. There are some strong moves in countries, particularly in Senegal and other places, where women are now taking the leadership and trying to do away with it. And the same thing exists in Liberia. I could name some other countries as well.
If many of the cultures we're talking about are deeply religious, including the United States as a whole, do you think that religion has to be the conduit for any real and lasting change when it comes to the subjugation of women? And what does that look like? What does religious change look like?
Well, that seems to be the easiest answer, but I don't think it is the answer, because it's very difficult to get, for instance, the Catholic Church to change its policies. I've written to the Pope, by the way, and I got an encouraging letter back from him saying that he believes that the status of women and the activity of women within the church needs to be increased. But there are some specific and very difficult things to overcome if the Catholic Church made that an ordained and official commitment. But at least the Pope, the new Pope, is aware of it and is much more amenable, I think, to some changes than maybe most of his predecessors.
What about in Plains, Georgia? Are these issues that you bring up in your Bible lessons?
Yeah, in Plains, we're making some progress, maybe because of my small influence in the tiny community. Certainly within my own church, we have a woman pastor, and my wife has been one of the deacons, and we have about half the deacons in our church as women. This hadn't been easy, but I think our church is committed to this policy.
Jimmy Carter served as the 39th president of the United States. His most recent book is titled A Call to Action: Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. He spoke with us from the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. President, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the questions, and thank you for letting me give the answers.
A few moments now to contemplate a few sentences.
The journal The American Scholar has put out a list of the 10 best sentences in fiction and nonfiction chosen by their editors.
In the office, we talk a lot, and we're sometimes struck by, you know, a beautiful sentence or, maybe a lousy sentence, and we'll just say, hey, listen to this.
That's Associate Editor Margaret Foster. Her choice was the last line of Toni Morrison's novel, Sula.
It was a fine cry, loud and long. But it had no bottom and it had no top, just circles and circles of sorrow.
Margaret Foster has thought a lot about what makes a sentence powerful, parallel sentence structures, and the use of repetition.
It's hard to describe, but it is, in the end, very subjective. I mean, who are we to say what the best sentence in The Great Gatsby is?
It's vanished trees, the trees that had made way for Gatsby's house, had once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of all human dreams. For a transitory, enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face for the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder.
That sentence from F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic, The Great Gatsby. Other writers that make that list, Joan Didion, James Joyce, and Truman Capote.
You know, who doesn't love In Cold Blood? The introduction when he's setting up the tiny town in Kansas, I just remember being moved by it. That's what we all talked about. What do you remember reading that just blew you away, that just stopped you in your tracks and grabbed you by the lapels?
Like the waters of the river, like the motorists on the highway, and like the yellow trains streaking down the Santa Fe tracks, drama in the shape of exceptional happenings had never stopped there.
The words of Truman Capote and one of the American scholar's 10 best sentences. Their whole list is at our website, npr.org. Like it or not, America has softened you. This is how the unnamed narrator of Teju Cole's new work of fiction is welcomed back to his home country of Nigeria. The book is called Every Day is for the Thief, and it's the story of a young man visiting his family and friends in the city of Lagos. What he finds there isn't exactly what he expected.
I really love the rawness of his response to his environment, the response of somebody who's been away a long time and doesn't want to pretty up the picture at all.
Teju Cole paints the picture for us in a series of vignettes. His narrator is pressed for bribes at every turn. He tries to reconcile Nigeria's history with the museums that appear to avoid it. He sees the so-called Yahoo boys at the internet cafe tapping out their scam email messages.
We've all seen those letters, and we've seen many of them. But to actually witness in person the origin of it, just to witness young men who are sitting down and composing these letters, was very fascinating to me.
In the book, you wrote about both the swindlers and the people that they're writing to. There is a sense, I think, in which the swindler and the swindled deserve each other. It's a kind of mutual humiliation society.
Absolutely so. You know, I mean, of course, it's unfortunate when you actually meet somebody or you read about somebody who has been scammed. But there is something to be said for being a grown-up in the modern world who knows well enough not to get excited about offers of money from strangers. You know, didn't you learn anything growing
up? In reading that chapter, I thought that the narrator would say, and here's how I now think differently about these men and their circumstances, and kind of give us a very sympathetic view. And the book doesn't do that. And it doesn't do that in a lot of chapters. And Did you feel apprehensive about these descriptions, that they'd be too harsh?
Well, I mean, in a way, this narrator is somebody who's far crankier than I would allow myself to be. And that was fun to explore. And I think it was also good because for those of us who are from Nigeria or who are from, you know, third world countries, I think there can be sometimes a tendency to write defensively.
I was going to say that. I've had that experience where my family's from Jamaica and I'm protective of it, how people see it. And I didn't feel that with this narrator.
I am very protective of the way people see Nigeria, except in this case, I just sort of let loose, in part because of my own grief at the way in which Nigeria had let itself down. And, you know, when this book was published in Nigeria, it was really embraced there. People really liked it for the unfiltered way in which it talked about what was going on.
Now, as you've mentioned, this book was published in Nigeria back in 2007. This is its first publication in the U.S. And at that time, where were you in your own life in relationship to Nigeria?
Well, I was living in the U.S. at the time, and like the narrator, I hadn't been back to Nigeria in quite a long time. In my case, it was an 11-year absence. There was sort of a lot of overlap there, just in the sense of going back to a place that had, A, changed a lot in some worrying ways, and B, not changed enough in terms of things that should have changed. And then thirdly, you know, signs of life. I think there are sort of moments of hope that are scattered through the book that say that this is a place where people live and get on with it one way or the other.
There's a great quote where you say, I suddenly feel a vague pity for all those writers who have to ply their trade from sleepy American suburbs, writing divorce scenes symbolized by the very slow washing of dishes. And the character is talking about how exciting it is to be in Nigeria.
Yes. Okay. Well, then, after writing that, I went on and wrote Open City, a book in which nothing happens.
You took a walk, a very long walk.
I took a very long walk in an American city, and the narrator got up to not very much. And I think that quote actually is a pretty good example of sort of not taking what's in the book as the author's own view, you know.
A little bit of a dig.
a bit of a dig, you know, a bit of a dig also at, you know, because the next line goes on to talk about if John Updike had had material that was more than Shillington, Pennsylvania, he probably would have won the Nobel Prize by now. and that's a dig at a man who at that time was still living. And he's sadly gone away now. But, you know, it was maybe a little bit of a rhetorical move. And the reality is that there are important stories to be told from any corner of the world. Having said all of that, Nigeria, I find excessively exciting. It's actually overwhelming.
This character is so invigorated and excited and finds all of these stories in Lagos. At the same time, there is a chapter in which he debates, why don't I live here? And is that something you've gone through as well? Or what did you want to kind of expose about that internal conversation?
I mean, I think that particular part was a little bit of an exploration of what a returnee's crisis might be. You know, it's a little bit of a trope of, you know, you go to a place that you know well and you just say, well, why can I not return? Why can't I live here?
And people worry about the brain drain from these countries. So
yes,
it occurred to
right.
me it could be any kind of professional who has this internal...
That's right. And there's a sort of vague sense of responsibility towards a place that formed you and all that. So I wanted to sort of dramatize that line of thought. But for me personally, I have not actually really considered seriously living in Nigeria full time. This is my home here, and this is the place that allows me to do the work that I do.
Meaning New York?
Well, New York, the United States. I'm fortunate to be able to travel to many places and to go to Nigeria often. And so I feel close enough to the things that are happening there without needing to live there. Maybe I'm less angry and cranky about it because I don't have to live there. And I don't want to put myself in a situation where I then hate a place because I forced myself to be there.
The main character of your book, he searches for books by Nigerian authors. He's visiting bookstores, and he thinks at one point there is a disconnect here between the wealth of stories available and the rarity of creative refuge. Do you see yourself as an author trying to address that disconnect?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that there's a sense in which myself and many others, many other young Nigerian writers, many other young African writers, we're sort of stepping into the gap of what we feel is sort of misrepresentations of contemporary African experience. You know, the first move towards true equality is to have the person you're addressing understand that you're just as complex as they are and that your stories are just as important as theirs are. So I think that is part of the work I do. Having said all that, I don't attempt to be representational. I just try to do the best work that I can and sort of testify to one single individual's complex experience of reality.
Teju Cole, he's the author of Every Day is for the Thief. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Audie. It was a pleasure.
A restaurant kitchen at the peak of the dinner rush can be a crazy place, hot, crowded. It can also be filled with a kind of energy that some people thrive on. Michael Gibney is one of those people. He's been working in restaurants since he was a teenager. In his new book, Sous Chef, Gibney tries to capture the feel of the kitchen. He takes readers through one day in the life of a fast-paced New York restaurant. NPR's Lynn Neary met up with Gibney in the kitchen.
Writing is a new affair for Michael Gibney, but cooking is his first love. He got his start in the restaurant business as a kid, washing dishes.
And that was not very glamorous at all. And I realized that the people who were cooking were having a much better time and seemed much cooler. I was sort of allured by the mystery that surrounded them.
Gibney loves the creativity of cooking and the adrenaline rush that comes with the challenge of preparing good food for a lot of people all at once. But he also likes the quiet early part of the day. As sous chef, Gibney is second in command in the kitchen, just under the chef. He knows things will get increasingly hectic as the day goes on, so he takes this time to think through what lies ahead.
It's most important to have a walk around. Have a walk around the dining room, have a walk around the entire kitchen, look through the walk-in boxes, make sure everything is in order, that there's no stock that's boiled away on the stove, nothing's actually on fire, and then start preparing yourself mentally for the day. Look at the numbers, and then get started on whatever's most important as quickly as you can.
Are you ready for this?
Gibney offers to show me around as preparations are underway for tonight's dinner.
So this is the main area of the kitchen. We're standing at the pass right now. This is where all the food gets plated.
The pass is a stainless steel counter at the front of a surprisingly small kitchen. A center island stretches to the back with narrow aisles on each side where the work is done. Big industrial-sized stoves line one wall. It's hard to envision how the staff manages to work in this compact space.
On average, I'd say at any given moment, if you were to take a picture of this room, there would be 15 or 20 people in it.
Wait, I have to say I'm being distracted now by this large piece of fish that somebody, the chef.
Chef Julian is about to butcher.
Hi, Chef Julian.
Hello.
Chef Julian Prudzianski has emerged with a huge cod. He stands at the pass, deftly wielding a sharp knife and talking with me as he cuts the fish into smaller pieces. In the book, Gibney describes the way people work together in a kitchen as the dance, and Chef Prudzianski agrees that a kind of choreography is essential for this type of cooking.
If everything's humming along smoothly, it's like, you know, I just stand here, pivot, grab the garnishes, put them on the plates, call the table, you know, look at the tickets. If everything's going smoothly, nobody has to move almost. You just know your place. And things start to fall apart when the two garmage cooks are crossing each other up. The entremet cook forgot whatever she's doing, and I have to run back there and, like, cook it for her. Then I can't look at the tickets, and everybody's out of place, and it's like a wheel spinning, and then it starts to lose its axis a little bit, like, and then the whole thing just falls apart.
In this passage from the book, sous chef Gibney captures what it feels like to get into the rhythm of the kitchen when the dinner hour is in full swing and everything is clicking.
Fat splutters, timers chime, food goes, tickets are stabbed, new ones plucked up. Organize the board, start again. 8 fish now, a pan to each, 8 butters, 8 garlics, 8 flips, 8 arrosés, 8 plates, 8 more picks. Machine gun frequency, clean pans in from Kiko, they're getting heavy. They drop on the flat top like a bullet blast. Your arms are stiff. The bronzino is done. Swing open the oven. The heat blazes. It dries your eyes. Blink it out. Grab up the Griswold. Bring home the door. The towel is wet. The pan burns your hand. Dizziness. Nausea. Synesthesia. Pain.
Talking with the chef, Gibney learns that tonight he'll be filling in for the cook who usually does the meat. He takes me over to the stove where he'll be working.
Be careful not to touch that area over there because you'll burn yourself.
It's already hot, and he hasn't even started cooking yet.
I will be standing right here for about 8 hours, sweating profusely over slabs of meat that are going in and out of these ovens. And I will be spinning around back and forth like this all night, and then coordinating times and sending everything up there.
To the outsider, it sounds like Gibney has a grueling night ahead of him, but he wouldn't have it any other way. He's ready for the dance to begin.
These are muscles that are actually going with that codfish.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.